There's no writer quite like David Foster Wallace. His stories can dazzle you with their run-on riffs on just about every subject imaginable. His essays are famous for their long footnotes and uproarious displays of his own neuroses. But for all the talk about his playfulness and sheer virtuosity, David Foster Wallace is very serious about the mission of fiction. As Steve Paulson discovered, consider this passage from a short story called The Soul Is Not a Smithy.
I had begun having nightmares about the reality of adult life as early as perhaps age 7. I knew, even then, that the dreams involved my father's life and job and the way he looked when he returned home from work at the end of the day. The nightmares themselves always opened with a wide-angle view of a number of men at desks in rows in a large, brightly lit room or hall. Some of the men were older than others, but they were all obviously adults, people who drove and applied for insurance coverage and had highballs while they read the paper before dinner. His arrival was always between 5:42 and 5:45, and it was usually I who was the first to see him come through the front door. What occurred was almost choreographic in its routine. He removed his hat and topcoat and hung the coat in the foyer closet, clawed his necktie loose with two fingers, entered the living room, greeted my brother, and sat down with the newspaper to wait for my mother to bring him a highball. In the foyer, turning from the front door while his left hand rose to remove his hat, my father's eyes appeared lightless and dead. His face was not at all like this on weekends off. His eyes, when he turned from the door, didn't scare me, but the feeling was somehow related to being scared. His hat went on the hat rack, his coat shouldered out of, then the coat was folded over his left arm. The closet opened with his right hand, the coat transferred to that hand while the third wooden coat hanger from the left is removed with his left hand. There was something about this routine that cast shadows down deep in parts of me I could not access on my own. Looking back, I suspect that there was something of a cover-your-eyes-and-stop-your-ears quality to my lack of curiosity about just what my father had to do all day. But I do not believe I knew or could even imagine, as a child, that for almost 30 years of 51 weeks a year, my father sat all day at a metal desk in a silent, fluorescent-lit room, reading forms and making calculations and filling out further forms on the results of those calculations. The nightmares were vivid and powerful, but they were not the kind from which you wake up crying out and then have to try to explain to your mother when she comes what the dream was about so that she could reassure you that there was nothing like what you just dreamed in the real world.
It's wonderful. Thank you. So evocative. Did you have that kind of dread when you were a kid?
I think in a country where we have it as easy as we do, one of our big dread vectors is boredom. And I think little edges of despair and soul-level boredom appear in things like homework or particularly dry classroom stuff. I can remember the incredible soaring relief of when certain teachers would say we were going to watch a movie in grade school. And it wasn't just a hedonistic, oh, we're going to have fun. It was a relief from some kind of terrible, terrible burden, I thought. So I don't know, maybe.
It was funny because as I was reading that, I was sort of thinking back to my own childhood. And my father was a professor, and he would typically go on up into his study, close the door, and I don't know what he did. But I remember thinking when I was pretty little that this doesn't seem like fun to have to sort of do this night after night. And I didn't want to become like that. Of course, I sort of have become like that because, you know, I go home and, you know, I have my own homework as well. But I'm wondering if that resonated at all for you.
I know one of my little family stories that Mom always tells is that on the day in second grade when we all had to talk about what our fathers did for a living, I said my father didn't do anything for a living. He just stayed home and wrote on yellow paper because he was a professor too. I know that part of what interested me in the story was trying to remember what I thought about what my parents did when I was a child. Because when you're a child, I don't think you're aware of how incredibly easy you have it. Right? You have your own problems and you have your own burdens and chores and things you have to do. But yeah, I think my intuitions were very much like yours. I think when they went into these quiet rooms and had to do things that it wasn't obvious they wanted to do, I think there was a part of me that felt that something terrible was coming.
Mm-hmm.
But also, of course, now that we're putatively grown up, there's also a lot of really, really interesting stuff. And sometimes you sit in quiet rooms and do a lot of drudgery, and at the end of it is a is a surprise or something very rewarding or a feeling of fulfillment.
You know, what I find interesting about what we've been talking about and also the passage you just read is your public image as a writer is you're typically described as one of the leading figures of the postmodern, hip, ironic generation of writers now in their 30s and early 40s. But I read somewhere that you really think of yourself as a realist.
You know, these various classifications are important for critics, right? You have to form different things into groups or else you have to talk about a trillion different particulars. I don't know very many writers who don't think of themselves as realists in terms of trying to convey the way stuff tastes and feels sort of to you. I mean, a lot of stuff that's like capital R realism just seems to me somewhat hokey because obviously realism is an illusion of realism, and the idea that small, banal details are somehow more real or authentic than large or strange details always seemed to me just a little bit crude. The truth of the matter is when you're in an interview, you have to say all kinds of stuff. I don't really know what I am, and I don't think very many writers have any idea what they are.
Mm-hmm.
You just try to do stuff that feels alive to you.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering about, for particularly people of our generation, I think we're roughly around the same age, both in our early 40s, whether there's a certain cultural landscape that you feel most compelled to write about.
I know that when I was in graduate school, those of us who wrote very much about what used to be called pop culture or advertising or television were really scorned by our older professors who saw that stuff as kind of vapid and banal and lacking a kind of platonic timelessness. And I remember it was a really big source of conflict because in lots of ways we just didn't get what they were saying. I mean, this was our world and our reality the same way, you know, the Romantics' world was trees and babbling brooks and mountains and blue skies. So I think probably if there's, yeah, I'm 42, if there's something that's distinctive about our generation is that we've been steeped in media and marketing since the time we were very, very small. And it's kind of a grand experiment because no other generation in the history of the world, you know, has been that mediated. What implications that has, I don't know, but I know it affects what seems urgent and worth writing about and what kind of feels real in my head when I'm working on it.
Well, I think the other piece of that is a lot of this commercial world, I mean, whether it's movies or, I don't know, advertising even, you know, it's really, it's pretty compelling, you know, it's entertaining.
Yeah.
And I suppose from a writer's perspective, you might want to feel like if you're going to write about this stuff, you have to be entertaining too.
Yeah, well, there's that danger. The other danger is kind of to reprise an early 20th century painting thing where once there was photography, the interest in, you know, mimesis and painting really kind of disappeared and everything got really abstract. It's a real problem. I don't have a TV anymore, but, you know, when I'm doing something like this and I'm on the road, I watch TV in hotels and I'm appalled by how good the commercials have gotten. They're fascinating. They're funny. They're hip. They've got trunk lines into my, you know, high school level anxieties and desires in a way that the commercials I grew up with never did. You know, what it is a lot of them are the hip, cynical, cool people I went to college feeling intimidated by who are now making $2 million a year figuring out how to do this stuff, and they've gotten very, very good at it.
Hmm. Well, I have to ask you about another one of your stories, The Suffering Channel, which, among other things, deals with a new kind of reality TV show that shows real-life episodes of torture and murder and rape and all of that. Is that sort of your vision of what might happen in some, you know, dystopian future?
I don't know that it's that. I think to the extent that I understand reality TV, it has a certain logic, and it's not hard to take that logic kind of to its extreme. I think Celebrity Autopsy, while childhood friends of the celebrities sit around talking about whether or not the celebrity was a good person while his or her organs are being excised, would be kind of the terminus of that logic. But the question is how far we go. At some point, people have figured out that even if viewers are sneering or talking about in what poor taste stuff is, they're still watching, and that the key is to get people to watch, and that that's what's remunerative. And I think once we lost that shame hobble, only time will tell how far we go.
I mentioned this essay that you wrote, I think it was back in 1993, about writing and sort of what various fiction writers are up to. And one point you made is that irony tyrannizes us. The implicit message of irony is, I don't really mean what I'm saying. And you went on to suggest that the next generation of rebel writers might ditch irony in favor of sincerity, and I think I'm quoting here, who treat plain old untrendy human troubles and emotions with reverence and conviction, who eschew self-consciousness and hip fatigue. And I guess...
Yeah.
is that a critique of your own kind of writing?
I don't know that it's that. I mean, the thing even sounds dated to me now. I think it's less that than an articulation of the thing you were asking me about before is, you know, what is it like to be working really hard on the stuff at age 42, having been marketed to all your life? I mean, because you want your art to be hip and seem cool to people. You want people to like the stuff. But a great deal of what passes for hip or cool is now highly, highly commercially driven. You know, and some of it I think is important art. I think The Simpsons is important art. On the other hand, it's also, in my opinion, relentlessly sort of corrosive to the soul, and everything is parodied and everything is ridiculous. Maybe I'm old, but for my part, I can be steeped in about an hour of it, and then I sort of have to walk away and look at a flower or something. I think if there's something to be talked about, that thing is this weird conflict between what my girlfriend calls the inner sap, you know, the part of us that can really wholeheartedly weep at stuff, and the part of us that has to live in a world of smart, jaded, sophisticated people and wants very much to be taken seriously by those people.
But can you hold those two impulses simultaneously?
No, but I think my personal opinion and what I tell my students is that if there's suffering involved in art, or however you want to say it, right now this is the form of the suffering, is to be the battleground for the war between those two kind of impulses, neither of which are stupid, neither of which are wrong, but it's not at all clear to me how to marry them. And I don't think it's been at all clear since about the 1950s. And I just think it's where we're at.
Is that what you're trying to do in your fiction, to sort of get at those two impulses within the same work, the same story?
For the purposes of this conversation, I'll say yes. But sitting in the bright, quiet room in front of the paper, it's much more, oh, does this make me want to throw up? Does this seem real? Is this the sort of thing the person would say? It's much more kind of boneheaded and practical than that. You realize this, right? There's something very artificial about once the book's all through galleys and, you know, now I'm engaging in critical discourse about it. I might be right, but it's very different than what it's like actually to do the things.
Sure, that makes total sense.
And the stuff that's in my mind as I'm doing it is far less sophisticated than this.
David Foster Wallace talking with Steve Paulson. His latest collection of short stories is called Oblivion.